This conference will now be recorded.
Welcome. It's October 27th, 2014. This is the Reading Odyssey's discussion of Lucretius on the nature of things. We're talking about books 3 and 4 and primarily the Copley translation. All right. Well, welcome, everybody. So we have some poetry, some Roman poetry to discuss on this fine October evening. So let's start with my favorite question, which of course is pick a passage or two that's a favorite passage from these two books and tell us a little bit about it. So who would like to go first? Anybody willing to go
actually,
first? Scott, how about you?
I like the even though I sent around that Philip Larkin poem making fun of it. I actually like the part where he says death is nothing, it concerns us not one bit, since the soul is proved to be an immortal thing.
Scott, I'm sorry. Remind us where you are, which book and
I'm so sorry. And I'm doing this electronically, so it says 177 of 375 on the electronic thing that I'm looking at. But anyway, book 3.
Is it book 3? Okay.
Book 3, line 8, beginning line, late 30.
It says
death is nothing, and it says just as in times gone by we felt no pain when tunic hordes came crashing from every quarter and everything quaked and shook with the shock of war, a world of ruin and terror beneath high heaven. And he really magnificently, it would be like World War II for us. Evokes the greatest of wars and says we felt nothing because we hadn't been born, and you know when we're dead it's the same.
Yeah,
we shall not
there's
be.
Nothing for us to fear in death, that a man who doesn't exist can't be unhappy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that right there is one of the key passages, isn't it? Great. Okay, let's see what else.
This is Alan.
Alan.
This is the first time I've ever run across somebody writing of these weighty issues that has a definite sarcastic sense of humor. And I just cracked up a couple times. The one I'm still chuckling over is on page 74, begins at line 776.
Okay, and we're in book 3, 776.
Book 3.
Okay.
To continue that at the sexual act of birth of animals, souls stand by is utter nonsense. Immortal souls waiting for mortal bodies in numberless numbers are running races to see which should be first, which favor to slip in. Or do the souls have contracts, sign and seals? The soul that sweeps in first shall have first chance to enter. No pushing or shoving, no arguing.
That's great, isn't it?
He's got all kinds of witticisms throughout this.
Yeah.
Passage for its snarkiness. I thought it was great.
Yeah. I love, and I wrote in the margin, do souls have contracts? I love that. The soul that soups in first shall have first chance to enter, no pushing or shoving. That's great. Good. All right. What else?
Well, in the less serious department, book 4, the passage about ugly, shapeless women, and line starts at line 1155.
Yeah.
How we see ugly, shapeless women love like precious darlings, which itself is pretty nasty, although that works in both directions as well, like the mystery of people who are devoted to people unworthy of them. But the more entertaining part was his going through all the euphemisms, you know.
Yeah.
Unkempt, unwashed, informal, she stare, you know, unwashed, informal, she stares a goddess, you know. Dumpy, she's exquisite, or tiny, but what a mind. Huge and clumsy, portentous, pure dignity, and so on and so forth. It was pretty funny. He obviously had some wit at play here.
Yeah. You just wish he had done it, you know, both directions. But what can we say?
Well, you know, this was a long time ago. Yeah, the pug-nosed, a saucy nymph, thick-lipped
right.
for kissing.
Right. Yeah, and I have to say, if I can, yeah, there's a passage that I thought was really funny. Let me see if I can get it. I mean, for the most part, he's kind of a moderate guy, but once in a while he comes out and just like that, you know, utter nonsense line somewhere in book four, I was looking for it. I underlined it earlier. He says something about, you know, if yeah, it's actually, where is it? Anyway, I'll find it. Who's next? Who would like to jump in? Josh?
Sure, I'll jump in. There was one line on, this is book three, line 894, I guess, is what it is.
Okay, and read it slowly so we can, you know, really savor it. Okay,
yeah, and it's actually, it's the first sentence that really jumped out at me, and he didn't mean it to be beautiful, but he was trying to sort of mock people who, you know, are mourning their loved ones. But it came out really beautiful when you read it. It says, you know, no more will happy home or loyal wife greet you, nor will sweet children run to catch first kisses and touch your heart with wordless joy.
Yeah.
And if you could talk a little more positively,
great
I thought
image.
It was a beautiful line.
Yeah.
No, he didn't mean it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that a lot, too. It's very poetic, very appealing, even though it says, you know, We're above and beyond that in a fashion, I guess. But I like that too, Josh.
Well, I think he's saying that not that we shouldn't enjoy that in life, but it's just everything's gone when we die, right? That's just
right.
The point I guess he's making. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Love that. All right, Les. What about you? Did you go?
I think Scott took my line 830, so I'll choose another one here that I like. Move over here. It's in book three. It's basically the last paragraph.
Hang on just a second. Okay, book three, sort of what line
It's 1076 to the end, really.
Why don't you read it to us and read it slowly so we can savor it.
Then, too, mid all these dangers, doubts, and fears, what vile, perverted lust for life subdues us. The end of life stands fixed for every man. Death cannot be avoided. We must meet it. Besides, we spin on the same spot round and round. We live on, but forge no new delights. The thing we want but don't possess seems far the best. We get it and beg for something else. We're held slack-mouthed with endless thirst for life, yet we don't know what fortune years may bring, what may befall us, or what end await. Nor do we, by dragging out our lives, take off 1 second from death's term. We have no power to shorten somehow our imprisonment in death. Live on then. Bury what spawn of men you will. The death that awaits will be no less eternal, nor will that man who made an end of life today not be a shorter time than he who died 1,000 years and months before.
Yeah.
This whole section made me think a lot of actually Hamlet and his to be or not to be from. And it also made me think about effective forecasting, basically, that we can't really predict very much what we want. Once we get it, we are not satisfied. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that line.
It's not as poetic, but I liked it.
The thing we want but don't possess seems far the best. We get it and beg for something else. You know, and that there's been a lot of research, you know, in behavioral economics that basically shows that once we get something we really want, it takes us about 6 months to acclimate to it, and then it doesn't give us the same buzz. We're done. That's great. Well, thank you, Les. Okay, let's see. Who else have we not yet heard from? Pat, do you have a passage you'd like to share?
Sure. It's in book three.
Yeah.
And it's a shorter one. I'm just trying to find it here. I liked, this is around line 273, around there in book three.
All right, hang on just a second.
Page 63 in the Copley.
Okay, line 273. Read and read it slowly so we can savor it with you.
He's talking about this fourth substance in addition to all the three sort of air components of the soul. He says, this force you see is hidden deep, deep down. It is the inmost element in the body, and is beyond that the soul of all the soul. As in our parts and the body as a whole, the force commingled of mind and soul lies hidden because its atoms are small and widely spaced. Just so this nameless substance made of tiny atoms lies hidden and is, as it were, the soul of the total soul and rules our total being. I just, there's something picturesque and poignant, I think, in a way about there being a soul of the soul. I don't know. That just struck me in a certain way. I mean, leaving aside the dubious science of attributing it to particles, there was something about it that, to me, the grain of truth in it is that, you know, our brains have electromagnetic impulses and there are chemical reactions that go on in our body that, you know, there's a way where his metaphor isn't 100% wrong either, it seems to me.
Yeah. I find that a lot with Lucretius, even though this stuff he clearly gets wrong, he's kind of touching on something that has some kind of sense to it.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Thank you, good sir. Let's see. Is Bruce Upton on the line, by the way? Bruce, did you call in? No? Okay. Who else have we not yet heard from?
This is Dwight. Excuse
oh,
me.
Oh, Dwight, good. Yeah, what about you? Give us a
sort of right after the famous part, you know, the, what was it, 8:30 or whatever, talking about death. Around 978, he sort of goes off. To me, this was like a very modern-day argument.
Are you talking about in book 379, page 79, 978? Is that where you are?
978, yes.
And all those things?
I'm reading.
Okay.
Read
it slowly.
Martin.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm reading from Martin Ferguson Smith, so it'll be a little different. But next, let me assure you that all the punishments that tradition locates in the atavism of Acheron actually exist in our life. No tormented Tantalus, as in the story, fears the huge rock suspended over him in the air, paralyzed with vain terror. But in life, mortals are oppressed by groundless fear of the gods and dread the fall of the blow that chance may deal to any of them.
Yeah.
And then kind of closing out that section, I'll skip to around 1018. Even though these horrors are absent, the mind, conscious of its guilt, and fearfully anticipating the consequences, pricks itself with goads and scars itself with scourges. It fails to see how there can be an end to its affliction or a limit to its punishment. Indeed, it is afraid that its sufferings may increase in death. In short, fools make a veritable hell of their lives on earth. And like I said, to me, that just sounds like a very modern-day argument for a lot of religion that people say, what happens in all of these stories are allegories for what's going on in our mind.
So let's read that last line again, and then I'm going to read it in the Copley. I love both translations, but read the Ferguson line again.
Okay. In short, fools make a veritable hell of their lives on earth.
Yeah. And Copley is, hell is right here, the work of foolish men, exclamation point. They're both quite good, and I think I like the Ferguson actually a little bit better. It is very modern, isn't it? I think you know that this passage is something that and to give credit to religious folks, there are a number of religious folks who talk about it is not okay to have hell on earth. But we have to do something about the lives that people lead here. The Catholic Church is doing something in some of these Ebola-stricken areas in West Africa, as are so many others. Great, Dwight. Thank you. All right. So, well, I'll tell you a passage that I like. But before I do, did we hit on everyone? I feel like maybe there's one person we haven't heard from. No? Okay. So actually, very close to where Dwight just left off is, I mean, there's so many passages here I like, but as Pat knows, I used to give a tour of the Met where we spent some time, you know, it was mostly the ancient galleries, and in the Roman galleries, we spent some time with some of the statues of famous men of ancient Rome whose names have not come down to us. So, of course, we have some statues, including Herodotus, is from ancient Greece, but we also have some statues in that section from ancient Rome of some clearly powerful men whose statues survive, but not their names. And for me, that's always I love that. It's such a great metaphor for, I feel like, what we all face. I feel it's a humbling way. And I love this passage here. So starting around, I'll read from 1024. So this is page 80. So also in book three. And this is right actually following where Dwight just left off. And sometimes to remind yourself of this, even the eyes of Ancus the Good grew dark. So it's the fourth king of Rome. And he was your better, for shame, a thousand ways. And other thousand kings and potentates have died, the governors of mighty nations. He too who once paved highways across the sea and built his legions a road across the deep, taught them to walk atop the pools of brine, sent prancing horse to spurn the ocean's roar, fell ill, saw daylight fade, and breathed his last. And this, of course, is a reference to Xerxes, who we all read about in Herodotus. And then he says, and this, I love this line, Scipio, thunderbolt warrior, scourge of Carthage, gave bones to earth just like the meanest slave. And he goes on from there. Let me just read a little more. Yeah, add the discoverers of truth and beauty. Add Helicon's host, meaning the poets, of whom great Homer's soul earned knight. Oops, what is that word? It must be kingship, right?
No.
Or is that knight? Is that a word? Is that a misspelling?
It's got to be kingship.
Yeah,
it's a transposition of the N and the I. It's got to be kingship.
Yeah, I thought so. I hadn't noticed it before until I was reading it. I had just read it as kingship. Like them all, he rests in peace. And you know, he goes on from there, talks of others. But Scipio, thunderbolt warrior, scourge of Carthage, gave bones to earth just like the meanest slave. Whew! That is some terrific writing, just a great concept. I found the other line. This is sort of funny. I think he doesn't mean it to be, but in book four, book four, line, what is this line? 914, I think, 11, 12, 13. 914, it's the bottom of page 103 in the Copley. It says, don't turn away with heart dead set against my truth. And next, top of the next page, when you are the one at fault and you just can't see. I'm going to use that in my next argument. And by the way, you know, don't ignore what I'm saying here, because you're wrong and you just don't get it. Dimwit.
Well, that's always persuasive.
Time.
Always.
What's
persuasive.
That? Yeah. Hey, Les, would you read that line to us from the Ferguson edition? It was you who had the Ferguson, right?
Yeah, I have Ferguson. I think Dwight has it too. So.
Okay. I don't have it in front of me. Can you read line 914 in book 4?
Yeah, let me get to it.
Sort of the end of line
914.
Yeah.
Be sure.
Are you doing? Do you want me to do it? This last.
Yeah, go ahead.
Be sure that you do not deny the validity of my account and turn from me with a breast impervious to true precepts when you yourself are at fault and cannot see. Very similar.
It's pretty similar. Pretty similar. Okay. Yeah, I love it. And furthermore, you suck.
But that's not the first time he, Phil, that he has really slammed the reader here. If you go on page 84 in book 4,
yeah,
line up 53,
yep.
But
yep.
He says, and here is proof for even the dull of mind.
Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, Les.
No, you know, he's supposed to be writing this to Memmius, but, you know, it sounds like he's maybe speaking to people in general.
Yeah, I think he forgot pretty, about him.
Yeah, he's working him over pretty badly if he's just talking to him.
All right, so let's now turn our attention to there's a lot in these two books. I thought we should address a couple of things in our call today. I want to make sure we talk about images, since he just goes off on images, and it's so interesting. And of course, I want to make sure we touch on sex. But he also, you know, in book 4, he walks us through food, thirst, walking, sleep. Dreams and so forth. And of course, in book 3, he touches on some of the things we've already begun to talk about, especially fear of death. So why don't we start there, actually? Why don't we start with fear of death? Would anyone like to sort of summarize what Lucretius believes about death? And I know we've kind of touched on it, but why don't we make sure we've addressed that before we move on? Who would like to start us off?
Well, this is Scott. I mean, I'll just say briefly, you know, just sum up what he says in a line. It's simply that the soul is not immortal, which, you know, spends a lot of time arguing. And since the soul is not immortal, you won't be there when you're dead. You know, you won't be aware. You won't be unhappy. You won't feel bereft. You won't feel anything. So you don't have to fear it.
Right, and I think he starts us off on line 418, page 66. Right, Scott? I think that's where we really get going in earnest on the fear of death. Can you read us the first four? Five, six lines there, maybe the first 10, I guess, something like that.
I'm starting at, I think it's 417.
Yeah.
Come now and learn that mind and soul, slight things, are born in living creatures and must die. For this, I spent sweet hours of toil to find verses worth your perusal. Here they are. Be sure that under one name you join the two, and when, proving the mortal, I say the soul, believe that the word will mean the mind as well, since both make up a unit, a thing conjoint. I think that's the...
Yeah.
And then he starts to describe, you know, what he conceives the soul to be.
Yeah. All right. And so let's see, what other key passages should we... I have to say, in the fear of, in this whole section, top of page 71 in the Copley, line 612, but if we had immortal souls, line 612, page 71, at the top there, but if we had immortal souls at death, they wouldn't complain of their destruction, but step out and slough their clothing like a snake. Okay. All right. So he has this part of this whole section where he's describing what happens when you die, and he kind of walks through that in detail, right? And says, well, you know, where is the soul that's supposedly escaping the body? Exactly when does that happen and how, and we don't see it. And essentially, therefore, it must not be there. One thing that I particularly liked in this section, and I'm sure he didn't consider it his most important, but I was trying to think, we don't hear a lot about ordinary day-to-day life from our ancient writers. You know, things like, for example, tooth decay. I'm reading that at the bottom of page 72. Line 691, for soul is so bound to viscera, sinew, vein, and bone, that even the teeth share in sensation. Witness decay, and there I assumed he meant tooth decay, and I thought, well, of course they had tooth decay, but I don't think Herodotus talked about tooth decay. I could be wrong. I don't remember reading. I was like, that's kind of cool, a little telescoping insight into the shock of ice cold water. Oh, they had that problem too back then. Of course they did.
And the problem of grit and bread.
Yes.
Which I don't know that we get it so much in bread, but grit and spinach I know is a common problem.
Yes. Yeah, why didn't he say spinach? Of course, well, they probably did have more grit in their bread.
Yes, you know? No, I'm sure they
bread.
Did.
I think the grit in the bread, and I don't know, some science show I read this, because they used to grind the flour with stones.
Yeah.
So what would happen is you get little pieces of stone ground into the flour, and you can obviously hurt your teeth.
If you go to Pompeii, you can see those little circular stone grinding mills that they use.
That's cool. I have not been to Pompeii. That's on the list. Maybe we should go as a group.
it's certainly worth the journey.
Yeah. Okay. Good. And then we have, of course, the do souls have contracts, which is just priceless. Thanks again to, was it Dwight who brought that up? All right. What more shall we say about fear of death? What do you think about these passages and what Lucretius here is saying? Do you see this in a new way, having read Lucretius? I'm not guessing it necessarily changed your ideas on mortality and the afterlife, but what do you think?
I mean, he addresses the one, you know, historically probably an overwhelming source of fear, which is the fear of punishment, which is still, you know,
yeah,
a large portion of the population still has that fear. But he doesn't really speak. I mean, I guess it's sort of woven throughout the Epicurean philosophy, but he doesn't speak as eloquently on, you know, the more ego-driven fear of death, you know, the fear of nothingness, right?
Oblivion, like yeah.
I'm conscious. I love my consciousness. Oblivion is terrifying, not because you think you're going to be punished, but because, you know, it's again, this sort of your ego finds itself so precious that it can't bear the thought of not existing. And he kind
right.
of... I mean, it's not that he ignores that, but he doesn't. It's clearly not the number one concern, right?
Right.
He almost assumes that nothingness is perfectly okay because you're not there to regret nothingness. So there's
right.
a logic to his argument, and of course, the whole book is about is from logic. So, or most of it is, but that I found a little less satisfying. He didn't. In other words, he didn't really speak to my personal anxieties as much as he might.
Right. Right. That's a very good point, Bill. I hear you. You know, a young family member of mine loved the book The Fault in Our Stars.
As did one of mine.
And for that reason, I saw the movie. And I don't know if any of you saw the movie, but there was this one truly Epicurean moment when the girlfriend is saying to the boyfriend, they both have cancer, you know, teenagers with cancers. I don't think it ruins anything to tell you that if you haven't seen it. And he is hoping to have some lasting legacy, some great impact that is world changing. And she finally says to him, "That is not the way it works. You are loved by your family and by me, and why is that not enough?" And she then further makes the argument that, look, there will come a time when humans as a species are gone, and no one will remember Caesar or Cleopatra at that point, and certainly none of us will be remembered. We will all be. It is all oblivion, essentially. I thought an interesting and poignant Epicurean moment. But you're right, he doesn't really address that head on the way he does the fear of punishment. What else? I don't know. Pat?
To me, it was an interesting, nuanced argument, because the modern sort of dichotomy is between, you know, a theistic approach that says the soul exists independent of the body and, you know, lives after the body dies. There's a whole segment of the populace believes that. And then the rational scientific explanation is usually basically boils down to, you know, the soul is a fictitious concept. There isn't any such thing. So I thought this was interesting that he's taking great pains to say, yes, we have souls. They're born when we're born, and they die when we die. That was, to me, an interesting presentation of it. And, you know, I'm not saying from a scientific standpoint, but from sort of a poetic and spiritual standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to me. There's something about that appeals to me.
Yeah. You know? And, you know, he addresses it. One of us read this line earlier, right? That the soul and the mind are essentially the same, according to Lucretius and Epicureanism. So one might argue that, you know, that he's essentially a modern version of this, is that the soul is a part of what goes on in the mind, in the, you know, and is born with us and dies with us, is essentially what he's saying. But I like your point, Pat. He is adding something that is not necessarily a part of the dialogue today on the rational side, but seems to have poetic resonance that is important. Cool.
Yeah, well, what I wonder about that is whether, in a sense, the term soul might be a mistranslation of what he intends, that he's really just talking about life, sort of the mystery of life, the life force. Because of your point, the point that he's saying the mind, you know, he's distinguishing between the mind and the soul. So obviously, sort of the conscious mind is something else than the soul. But the soul, if you think about how we would describe people today would describe it, what he calls the soul, we would just say is sort of the life force. And he's saying, yeah, the life force is just part of your body and it goes away when you die. So he may not mean it. I mean, I don't know what the experts would say. Maybe he doesn't mean when he uses whatever the Latin term he's using for soul, he may not mean what we mean. We think of the soul in this Judeo-Christian religious context. And he may not have that in mind. He just may mean life.
There's a note on the bottom of page 60 that talks about mind and soul. in the context of Lucretius.
Okay.
It says, as here stated, how Copley's describing it. As here stated, yeah. The mind is the central governing entity located naively by Lucretius in the breast. The soul is the diffused entity scattered throughout the body. He's saying in function, Lucretius's mind is similar to the brain, his soul to the nervous system, but neither he nor Epicurus ever made this association.
Yeah. Yeah, I get a sense that he doesn't quite mean life force, but it'd be good. That's a good question for, I need to figure out which scholar is going to join us. Actually, I need to get on that for our last call next month. It'd be great to ask what the ancient Romans meant or the Epicureans meant by soul and how that may be different from the Judeo-Christian sense that we have all grown up with.
If you think about the key concept that really, I wouldn't say cripples his interpretation, but really makes it to us seem naive or alien, is he doesn't, you know, he only understands matter. He doesn't understand energy and certainly not electricity, you know, electrical impulses. You
right.
know, and that when you think about where he seems naive or misses the mark, it's because he's trying to explain everything in terms of matter, but
right.
because he, there is no concept of energy.
Yeah,
I think he kind of addresses that in book four, though. To some
yeah, extent. Where would you say?
Well, he talks about there's what the senses gather, but
yep.
then he also talks about this membrane-like substance that's thin
yep.
That also affects the senses, sort of like a spider web or what he got leaves of gold or something like that, and that's the combination of what our senses perceive, both what is actually there and you know, your sight, and then also sort of what it feels from that sight affects how we react to things.
But I think he still thinks it's all atoms. Like everything is
yeah.
atoms, even images
I think
atoms.
I won't disagree with that, yeah.
Yeah.
Although he does refer, you were correct, to things like motion and mobile. At one point, he even says the mind is mobile on line 748.
All right, because everything's in motion, right? That's where the swerve
yeah.
was about, right? Is
yeah.
Because
yeah.
there's a void and there's a swerve, everything is in motion and chaos, which
right.
is what makes
Although
life possible.
I don't quite understand the swerve, I have to admit. I kind of get it, but I kind of don't.
But that may be the swerve's fault, though, not your fault.
It may be, in fact. By the way, I just want to point out on page 72 of the Copley edition, there's a footnote noting that this is where Lucretius is attacking the theory held by the Pythagoreans and by Plato, referring to Plato's dialogue, Phaedo, that learning is at least in part simply memory of things known in a previous existence. Some of us read that dialogue together, and I remember that. And I don't think it's from a previous existence, but maybe it is. I love that. Do you guys remember? Bill, Pat, I think you guys were. Maybe Josh. I forget.
Yeah, I was there
yeah.
for that.
Yeah. Okay. All right, cool. Let's move on. All right, so we've addressed immortality, or mortality, more to the point, I suppose. I guess I just want to say one more thing about that, which is, I guess, to your point, Bill. You know, with my mother's death a couple years ago, I woke up this morning having had a dream of my mom, and I was very sad. And I think when she died, I realized she had a lot of photos. My mother was, Pat was just obsessed about taking pictures. She actually was a photographer, but then she also took tons of family photos. And she had boxes and boxes of these photos. And I realized when she died, I was going to save a few of these photos, but the whole collection, there was no one around anymore who cared about that whole collection of photos? And that just made me intensely sad for some reason. And the notion that we're gone, that there's just a void, oblivion, which I happen to believe, does make me immensely sad. And in some ways I find it reassuring, especially the idea that, you know, Scipio, you know, the thunderbolt warrior, he too fights the dust as much as the meanest slave. And I find that somewhat reassuring, but I also find it sad. And I don't know how other people grapple with that, or if you do, or how you see that. I'd love to hear.
I think that was well spoken, Phil. I appreciate your sharing this last. I tell you guys, you know, death is something, and it does concern me. However, it's a matter of probably keeping it in perspective. As long as you're alive and healthy and built as we are, we're built to live. That's kind of what we're meant to do. He's taking an extreme position here, and you know, probably no one on this line really wants to die. And so death is something, you know, it is something we would prefer not to choose. But if we can accept it and live with it and not be held ransom by other philosophies or different people or religions or circumstances, to me, that's probably more important, because I'm with Phil. I will be in the oblivion. But while I'm here, it's death is, I would rather not die. And so that means it is something. And I think that's the way we're the creatures we are. That's the way we're structured, I believe.
Yeah.
So I understand about keeping it in perspective. I probably cannot honestly say those exact words. So I think I understand. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
You know, that's a great comment, because I think, as I read this, especially on page 64, in line about 318, there is a dynamic tension that runs throughout these two books. And what Lucretia says is, this one thing, though I see, I can affirm. In human nature, the problems that remain insoluble by reason are so petty that nothing prevents our living as God should be. And if that's not an homage to a rational life that avoids emotions, but then he wrestles and tries to show you how emotions, fear of death, sexual passion, need to be overcome. And I don't think he quite makes the case, as somebody said earlier on, positing this as a truth and then trying to address all these emotional issues that we all face as human beings.
Yeah. This is a great passage, by the way. I'm glad you brought that up, Alan. Yeah, that's what we're going to ask.
No, I'm just saying we do carry a lot of emotional baggage. No doubt about it.
Yeah, maybe it's not baggage. I mean, there's certainly, we're emotional beings.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, well stated. Yeah, like I was trying to emphasize earlier, I don't think we could be otherwise very easily.
Right.
But to strive for reasonableness and perspective on it. It's also, I think, has value. So
let's
I'm
spend
still
just
with
a moment. Yeah, yeah. Let's just spend a moment. So book four. First of all, love the lines 8 through 8, is that 8? Yeah, 8 and 9. I turn the bright light of my verse on darkness, painting it all with poetry. Whew, that's good stuff. I like that. Or he's painting it here with poetry. Okay. So he goes on to talk about images. Images, hallucinations, and he says, are not ghosts of hell.
What lines, Phil? Sorry.
I'm going to just... That was line 42 and 43, I think.
Okay.
And then line 110, delicate is the nature of images. And then line This is great. Line 136, thus we see clouds sometimes grow effortlessly in heaven and mar the firmament's clear face with air caressing movement. Just love that language. And then on, let's see, line 240, images of things ride everywhere. And then he keeps going. And, you know, on page 90, and what the hell is he talking about? What is his fascination with images? He goes on and on and on and on about images. Why are, so my question to all of you, why are images so important to Lucretius? What's he talking about here? Anybody have a point of view on that? Bill, can I cold call you on that question? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think the book is basically trying to unlock a lot of the mysteries of existence.
Yeah.
Explain them, and I think this one is what's one of the most obvious mysteries if you don't understand the actual physics of it, which is that sight, that you see things.
Yeah.
How do you, everything's made up of atoms, then what are these things you see and what does that mean? You know, and how does that happen? And I think he's struggling to explain it. And given how, I mean, this is where his explanation, I mean, it's kind of interesting because in some ways you could say, well, you know, I think what someone said about it, one of his other sort of claims about physics, it's, if you look at it as, if you give him some slack and look at it as a little metaphorical and say, well, it's kind of like atoms are kind of like photons. And, you know, he's not completely off, but it's a real struggle to explain sight when you think everything is made up of atoms. And I think it takes him a long time to work it out. And, but he even goes, I mean, what I actually liked in that whole explanation is when he talks about centaurs and, you know, these, these chimeras that can't possibly exist. Well, where does this come from? And he's basically saying these atoms are getting mixed up.
Yeah.
Right. Atoms of a horse and a person, because there's so many, it's so complicated. They're getting mixed up, and that's where the centaur comes from.
That was great.
Not a bad idea, by the way.
Yeah. Because he, in other words, he thinks that images are real things. I mean, that's what's so interesting.
Right.
They're not, I mean, we see it as light reflecting off of a surface. That doesn't really explain what light is, but he sees images as real physical objects.
Right.
All images, the sun, the moon, the stars, clouds.
Yep. Good, Bill. That was helpful.
I thought his trying to explain depth perception was really brilliant.
Do you want to read to us from some of that?
I'm trying to find, do you remember where it is, Bill?
I think it may be in this section on page 92, which is, I think this is with the 2,000 arrow shots and 500 javelin casts and all that stuff. I think that's where he's talking about depth perception.
He's talking about the winds and how you can tell how, where is it?
Yes, it's down. And yet a puddle no more than a finger's depth held in the street between the paving stones. Let's us look down into earth and see as far as yawning heaven spreads high and wide from earth. One seems to look down on clouds. Oh, I guess he's talking about seeing the clouds in the puddle here. Maybe that's not exactly where it was.
There's a point saying that you could tell how far something away was because when images move, it moves the air in front of it. And so you can tell. So the more air that has been moved when it hits your pupils, you know, therefore, how far away something was.
Right. Right. Yes, I do. Yes, where is that? Does anyone know where that is? This was a very important concept, is that thing of pushing the atoms of the air ahead of it.
Find it in a second. Here you go. 88 and 89.
Okay.
It's near 88 there.
Yeah, below that, images riding everywhere in all directions. Right.
Right.
Yep.
My daughter, I read that passage. My daughter, she had an interesting question. She said, well, what happens when it's windy outside? How does that affect air being moved towards your eyes? I didn't have a good answer for her.
You told her you'd speak to Lucretius and get back to her. Now, okay. Any other points on the images? All right, let's move on because I want to make sure we hit sex. In fact, let's go to sex now. Got to talk about sex. Sex, where are we? Page, what is this? 107, I think. I think it's the bottom of 106, actually. Where does it start? Does it start? Yeah, it starts, I guess, the top. Top of 107, I guess. Thus he who's wounded by the bolt of love, and I wrote wounded by love, whether a boy with girlish limbs has struck him or a woman darting passion from every pore. Of course, again, we're talking only from the point of view of adult Roman men who are either interested in boys or women, turns toward the source of hurt and aches for union to jet his humors body into body. Desire, though wordless, tells of joys to be. This we call Venus, hence we speak of love and of that drop of passion, first and sweet, that trickles into our heart and brings cold care. Cold care, I underline that. For if your love is absent, still her image is with you and her name sings in your ear. All right, here we go with image. But we must shun these images and scare off what feeds our love and turn our thoughts elsewhere and jet our humors into someone's body, not keep them. And once trapped by one lone love, save up sure woe and worry for ourselves. For if the cancer is fed, it lives and grows. In time, folly's a fever and pangs are millstones. If fresh hurts aren't distracted by new bruises, new wounds of love, I think he means, and we don't take to the streets to cure young love or else divert our thoughts and minds elsewhere. Nor, lacking passion, must one lose love's joys. Rather, one gains pure happiness at no cost. I think this is the key to the whole thing. I think he means you can get joy and happiness if you lose lust, if you lack passion. So, and then he goes on to, whatever they seize, they crush, inflicting pain just a few lines down of body. Sometimes they press tooth into lip and kiss like a flail, for theirs is no pure pleasure. In it are lash and goad, perforce to hurt that object whence this burgeoning madness rose. It's very Shakespearean, actually. Clearly Shakespeare read these lines. So what do we think about Lucretius's? First of all, who would like to try to explain what Lucretius has to say about sex? And then we can talk about what we think about it. I'd like to take a stab at that. Scott?
He's basically trying to figure out how to say this. I mean, first of all, he's obviously arguing very strenuously that you shouldn't let lust, desire for sex, rule your life, because that will, you know, that will take you away from, you know, the sort of calm contemplation and absence of want that is the essence of happiness. And
yeah,
I think at the root of this is his concept that pleasure is an absolute without degrees, and that it means more the absence of pain than anything else. So he can't really conceive, no pun intended, of the extraordinary pleasures that just totally unbounded love can bring to people. And he's trying to warn us against that. But since he doesn't really believe in it, it's hard for him to do it justice.
Yeah. So, good. I think that's a good... What do we think about Lucretius? Do we think he's... as the footnote on page 107 describes, is it a tirade against love? Or is it something different than that? And what do we think? Do we agree with Lucretius? Has he helped us think differently about this?
It would seem like it's a tirade against passion, not love, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I took.
It is
anti-passion because passion will eventually cause pain. Because after all the storm and drawing that he goes through, he ends up at the end with a very interesting sentimental piece.
Yeah. Tell us about it. Read to us from that.
In the very last, nor is it by hand of God and shafts of Venus that a girl ill-favored of form may yet find love. For sometimes by her works and ways, by kindness, patience, neatness, and good taste, woman may win you to share a life with her. And anyway, habit's the builder of affection, for things, though lightly struck, yet constantly, in the end, are overcome and must give way. You see how even drops of water falling on stone in course of time bore through the stone.
Yeah,
to me, he's speaking very specifically about sexual passion. He's using love as a euphemism for that. Or this translation is using love as a euphemism, it seems to me, because he'd have a different stance on love itself as one of those higher pleasures, I would think. I thought it was interesting, you know, he's saying, this is on page 108 around line 1091, actually just above that 1089. Love is the one thing right at the top of the page, of which the more we have, the more the heart burns with insane desire.
Yeah.
And he compares it to how the body handles food and drink. Now, food and drink are taken into the body, but since they settle in predetermined spots, our need for bread and wine is readily filled. But from a human face and soft, smooth skin, the body gets nothing to use but images. Slight things, poor hopes, the wind oft whips away, as one in dreams who thirsting looks for water but finds none that might cool his fevered flesh. So Venus deludes fond lovers with simulacra. It's like he's saying that, you know, sexual passion can never be satisfied. It's this, you're left with something so insubstantial that it has no hope of satisfying your desire.
Yeah. Images.
Yeah.
Brings it all in there. Yep. So let me ask another question. And Pat, feel free to chime in here. What do you think of the poetry of this? Of his language, did any of you find yourselves underlining points where you felt he was doing something, or at least the translator was doing something interesting with the language and near rhymes and interesting, surprising combinations? We'll wrap up tonight's call with this question. Well, it may not.
You did.
I did. And with that, we're done.
You can share, Phil.
Well, I'm looking for this one point. At the beginning of book four, I read to you before about the painting it all with poetry, which I quite liked. But a couple lines down from that, line 14, in fact, it is tricked and brought to set the cup to his lip. I really like the tricked and lip. That was a nice, surprising kind of combination. And I love this, you know, I wish to tell my tale in sweet Pyrrhian song for you, to paint it with the honey of the muses, hoping that thus I might fix your attention upon my verse until you clearly saw the nature of things and understood its value. The sweetness to those lines that I quite liked. I read earlier that souls have fled from hell. line 42 or so. Bottom of page 84, line 76, 78, 79. People, pit, stage, and scenery. And then we lose the rest of those words. But I love that. People, pit, stage, and scenery. Those interesting collection of words. I like the rhythm. Let's see what else. I mentioned earlier, and I'll say it again, the lines on page 86, line 136, clouds sometimes grow effortlessly in heaven and mar the firmament's clear face and air caressing movement. Firmament and movement and air caressing movement. Love the language there. Let's see what else. I have to say, I don't know if anyone understood this, but line 299, I guess, line 289, I wasn't quite sure what he was saying here. And so it is not, comma, not right for us to wonder. What? Is that what he's saying? That is, he doesn't want us to wonder? Does anyone know? We're talking about a mirror here, and I just wasn't sure. What
line again, Phil?
It's 289. It's the line right above the three asterisks towards the bottom of page 89.
Well, it notes in the footnotes that a line is lost, so it might make more sense, because I couldn't make, yeah. I didn't understand that either. But
I think that's probably, I saw that note. I think I probably all have to say about that. Okay. And I'll just find a couple more lines. Well, I really like this idea. So page 92, line 408, where he's measuring distances that we can see by virtue of how many arrow shots away they are. 2,000 arrow shots away, or better, 500 javelin casts. That's cool. I like that a lot. I like that idea. I might use that in a future poem. Or
well, how can a javelin cast be longer than an arrow shot?
I have no idea. I guess if you've got Hercules throwing that javelin, it's going to go pretty far.
Well, I think he's saying that it's closer, that we're talking about the sun.
Or scarce. Right. Or better, even closer. Right. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it is.
Yeah. I love the idea that if you speak a lot, you lose some weight.
Yeah, that's good news, huh?
Yeah.
Since you speak that Link uses some weight, I think, you know, we should tell the senators that the next time they want a filibuster, it's a great weight loss tactic.
Given their, I don't think it's true.
Oh, you don't think it's true. Given their girth. yeah, that's pretty funny. All right. Well, that's just a little bit. I love the lions afraid of chickens, and he has a footnote on that.
Yeah.
That antiquity, that's this sort of myth that they all thought. By the way, did anyone notice this? This might be a typo on page 70, 101. Excuse me, line 793. The images must be artistic. Is that a word, artistic? I meant to look that up. Or is it artistic? Is that the images must be artistic?
I would guess it.
No, it's
artist.
Kind of a typo.
Yeah.
I guess it's artist rather than that.
Or artist, that. Yeah. The images must, yeah. Yeah. What does the Ferguson translation say, by the way? Line 792. Line 792.
792. The roving images must indeed be gifted and expert performers to be able to provide these nocturnal entertainments.
Yeah, it's got to be artists. Yeah, okay. So we found a couple titles. We should send them into the publisher, the author, whatever. All right, good. Well, there's more language in here, but for sure that I liked, but those are a couple samples. All right, guys, so we have our last call in a month. Any parting words before we hit book 5 and 6?
Really enjoying it so far.
Yeah.
Very different than the other. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I am too, very much. All right. Well, that takes us through The Nature of Things, books 3 and 4. We go now. Fear not death. Have some sex, but not too much. All right.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody.
All right.
Okay, everyone have a good night.
Good night.
Have a good 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
The organizer has disconnected, and this conference will continue for 60 minutes.